From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Today, an advisory panel to the Food and Drug Administration is weighing a critical question, whether to approve Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine. FDA vaccine expert Doran Fink thinks the vaccine will be okayed for emergency use.
Today, we will be considering whether to make available to millions of Americans an as-yet investigational vaccine that has been developed, tested, and reviewed in record time. The American public demands and deserves a rigorous, comprehensive, and independent review of the data.
Joining us now is former FDA Commissioner Mark McClellan. Dr. McClellan is a professor of business, medicine, and health policy at Duke University. Welcome back to Here and Now.
Tanya, good to be with you.
What do you expect the FDA to decide when it takes up this emergency use authorization today? And are you confident that this FDA will not rush this process?
Well, the FDA has definitely not rushed the process, even though we're in the midst of a pandemic. They've been through a very thorough set of phases, guiding the companies through how to do very large randomized clinical trials with tens of thousands of people who volunteered to really provide some actual evidence on how well the vaccine works in preventing infection complications and whether there are any side effects. And now, as a further step, it's having a review by an independent group of experts. So there's not going to be a decision today, but I expect a decision very quickly about authorizing the vaccine based on all of this evidence that's come together so far.
You mentioned the side effects. Are you concerned about them? We've heard about them out of the UK, where they've started vaccinations already. Headaches, fatigue, aches. Are you going to be taking the shot? Will you take the shot?
Based on what I've seen, I would, Tanya. And I think it's important for people to know that vaccines do have side effects. And the question is just, are they manageable side effects, or are they ones that are serious enough that they really would create concerns about the appropriateness of authorizing the vaccine for use by millions of people potentially? So the vaccine side effects that we know about include things like you mentioned, sore arms, fever, feeling like you've got the flu, muscle aches and pains. And that's kind of a sign that you're having a strong immune reaction to the shot. It's a stronger set of side effects soon after you get the vaccine than most people experience with the flu vaccine, maybe more like for older Americans who have had it, a shingles vaccine, where you can kind of feel pretty bad for a day. So people are definitely going to notice it in most cases. The real question, Tanya, is whether those side effects last, whether there are any more serious side effects down the road. And there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of evidence of that.
One other thing that folks are talking about, it's also unknown when immunity kicks in after taking the shot or how long it lasts. What will you be watching for?
Yeah, so we won't have the answers to some of those questions that are just going to take watching how people do with the vaccines for a lot longer time. That is a fact of trying to develop a vaccine quickly. It looks like it lasts for at least a few months, but we're going to have to do further studies after the vaccine is authorized to see how people who get it do over the longer term, and also to answer some other questions that we just don't know about yet either, including questions like, does it prevent you from infecting other people? And that makes a big difference, Tanya, for whether we can start relaxing things like wearing masks or keeping a distance until lots more people are vaccinated.
Let's talk a little bit about vaccine distribution. Pfizer has said there will be fewer vaccines available than initially thought. Other vaccines are on the way, as we know. Do you think that there's going to be enough?
I think it's going to take some time before every American can easily get access to a vaccine. In the month of December, even with some of the short-term shortages that Pfizer has recently announced, the federal government is still expecting about 20 million Americans should be able to get vaccinated, assuming the Pfizer vaccine is approved and then the next one, the vaccine from Moderna, gets approved in the following week or so. And those vaccinations are going to go to people at the very highest risk. So people in nursing homes where we've seen so many deaths, and also the frontline healthcare workers. And then after that, we can probably expect another 20, 30 million people to get vaccinated in January. And after that, maybe more, because there are, as you said, additional vaccines that may be coming along in the February, March timeframe. But that still means it's going to be a while into the spring before every American has a chance to get a vaccine. And we're going to be going from highest to lowest risk with the next groups, including older Americans who are at higher risk, people who have serious chronic diseases who are at higher risk, maybe people with obesity, also frontline workers in essential industries, people who are working in food processing plants or close to others as part of their jobs. So yeah. Those will be the people in the January, February timeframe. And for most other Americans, it's going to be probably March or a little bit further into the spring before they get a chance.
That's Mark McClellan. He's a former commissioner of the FDA. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you.
Well, moving to the EPA, this week the Trump administration declined to strengthen a regulation on soot emissions, despite advice from scientists at the Environmental Protection Agency who linked tiny particles in soot to respiratory illnesses, including COVID. It was a Harvard University study which found a link between those particles and adverse outcomes in COVID-19 patients. Andrew Wheeler, the head of the EPA and former lawyer for coal magnate Robert Murray and lobbyist against environmental regulation, who is now head of the EPA, made the announcement. Coral Davenport covers energy and the environment for the New York Times. Coral, start by telling us about what essentially is a new regulation, but it's a refusal to change the old one.
Right. So under the law, under the Clean Air Act, the EPA is required every 5 years to review the existing science on this particular pollutant. It's basically industrial soot. It's the most widespread pollutant in the U.S. and responsible for the most deaths. The regulation was last tightened in 2012 during the Obama administration. Since the last time it was tightened in 2012, there's been a huge amount of new science on the links between PM2.5 pollutant, this industrial soot, and respiratory diseases. The EPA's own scientists wrote in a report last year that if this regulation was tightened just by about 25%, it could save over 10,000 lives a year in the United States from respiratory illness. And that's before COVID-19. And then, as you said, this Harvard study came out earlier this year drawing links between exposure to this exact pollutant and higher rates of COVID-19. There was a lot of science, including the EPA's own scientists, concretely recommending that the EPA tighten this. And so the scientific and public health community was horrified that the Trump administration did not take this new science into account. And they did this five-year review, and they said our conclusion based on reviewing the science as we're supposed to is there is no need to further tighten the regulation on this pollutant.
Well, when Wheeler was asked by reporters in this announcement about the Harvard study, he said that it was published in April and the peer review wasn't completed until November, so it would have been inappropriate to consider it, was the reasoning that he gave. But as you said, there were thousands of people who, you know, in the public comment on this, scientists who had weighed in. When Andrew Wheeler, again, now EPA head, former lawyer and lobbyist for the coal industry, made this announcement, he was joined by the governor and lieutenant governor of West Virginia. They made no bones about the fact that this was a celebration, a victory for them and for the coal industry.
Absolutely. When the EPA administrator, whose job it is by mandate to protect public health, made this announcement, he was joined by the governor and the deputy attorney general of West Virginia. The deputy attorney general of West Virginia spoke as well, and he said this rule represents a big win for West Virginia coal. He said if they had tightened this rule, it would have been a huge blow to the coal industry, which is true. But pollution from coal-fired power plants is one of the biggest sources of this pollutant. And as you mentioned before, of course, Andrew Wheeler himself is a former lobbyist for a coal company.
Well, and this is also part of the Trump administration rolling back much environmental regulation. But a new president is coming in. Is there a sense, and briefly, is there a sense then that he can overturn this or write a new regulation, his administration can?
Yes, this is one of the rules that will, I think, be fairly easy for a Biden administration to make a change on. The law says this regulation has to be reviewed and revised every 5 years, but it's at least every 5 years. So a new administration can come in and say, we're going to review and revise this right now, and decide to look at the existing science and go ahead and tighten this regulation. And of course, as you said, that Harvard study did only complete peer review in November, but a new administration could then go in and say, okay, we've got this study, it's peer reviewed, we're going to, you know, this is linked to COVID. And that would be a very strong scientific and thus legal case for tightening it pretty early on.
New York Times environmental reporter Carl Davenport, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Robin.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from the Boston Foundation. For more than a century, a resilient city and region have relied on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve our most serious problems. The Foundation's work has been strengthened by hundreds of people who've left legacies to support our community. Leaving a charitable legacy at the Boston Foundation is a great way to have an impact now and in the future. Learn more at tbf.org/partner.
Nearly one out of three Black people in America know someone personally who has died from COVID-19. That's according to a Washington Post Ipsos poll. And while we're now at a point where an effective vaccine is on the horizon, there's concern over whether people will trust it. Black people make up 13% of the population here in the U.S., but only on average 5% of vaccine trial participants. All of this was on the mind of Dr. Chris Purnell. The New Jersey public health physician signed up for the Moderna vaccine trial after her father, Timothy Purnell Sr., died from the virus in April. And Dr. Purnell, I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been a surreal time. I think those are the best words that I can use to describe it. We lost my dad at a time when the epicenter of the pandemic had firmly landed on Newark, New Jersey. And as I like to describe for people, just to get a sense of the gravity, it firmly landed on us.
Mm. Your father, what a guy. He worked for Bell Labs for more than 30 years. He was a husband, a father to you and your siblings. As you mentioned, he died right at the time when we were really grappling with this pandemic in April. We're still very much so. But how did he get sick with COVID-19?
So my father was actually battling for his life in the fall and winter of 2019, and we weren't sure he was going to survive, but my dad is the bionic man. And so he actually got discharged from the hospital on New Year's Day, 2020, and went to subacute rehab. And we saw subacute rehab as an opportunity for physical reconditioning, to stabilize him. And as he would describe, you know, I just want to get back home to live out the home stretch of my life surrounded by family and my grandkids. And so that's what we were doing when unexpectedly my dad got something that we call medically a line infection. He had been on long-term antibiotics at the subacute rehab and suddenly became ill one day with unstable vitals, very high fevers. And he had about three of those episodes before his care team said, look, we're going to have to test him for coronavirus. It's rampant throughout the hospital. And unfortunately, he got it.
Oh, I am so sorry, doctor. You also lost your cousin to the virus.
Yes.
And your sister tested positive.
Yes. Actually, today are the virtual services for my cousin. He suffered what is believed to be a complication of COVID, catastrophic stroke and blood clots in his lungs. Young man, late 50s, vivacious, full of life, and coronavirus snubbed and stole another life in my family. And my sister, who has just been our champion, a breast cancer survivor, my sister likely got exposed at work and she got sick and has been fighting coronavirus, is what we call a long hauler. And at one had to be on supplemental oxygen, which she just ended about a few weeks ago, but she's yet to return to work.
All of this, your role as a doctor, as a daughter, as a Black woman, all of this, I can imagine, informed your decision to volunteer for Moderna's vaccine trial.
Yes. COVID had taken so much from me. I had to take something from it. And I needed a way to live forward my father's legacy. My dad was a research scientist. And so I didn't hesitate when this opportunity presented itself. I believe in public health science. And finally, I would also add, I'm very well aware, being a doctor that focuses on health equity, of the health inequities that Blacks and Browns face, in particular around our participation in clinical research. And I knew that if we represented, that inequity would only continue and persist. So those are all of the things that were going on in my emotional and spiritual milieu that definitely solidified this choice for me.
Well, let's talk a little about that. The statistics from vaccine trials show Black people are vastly underrepresented in these trials. We've talked quite a bit about the inherent and often warranted distrust Black people have had with medicine and science because of the Tuskegee experiments and others. But what are some of the reasons you believe in 2020 why Black people are still underrepresented?
You started the conversation where we still have to start. That historical legacy of medical experimentation and exploitation still weighs collectively on the psyche of Black folks and Black communities. And academic medicine and healthcare more generally has not done enough to demonstrate trustworthiness. And when I say has not done enough, we have to start by centering on the history and validating the fears and concerns. And then we have to make sure that we are informing Black and Brown communities of opportunities in socially and culturally fluent ways. And then we have to make sure that Blacks feel seen. And I say that and I pause because we don't only have historical issues. We don't only have access and issues around opportunity. We also have issues around ongoing disparities in healthcare, right? And a part of those ongoing disparities in healthcare is that Blacks don't see themselves reflected in healthcare. And the more we can increase Black frontline physicians and healthcare providers, it messages to the community that I see you, that your input and your lived experiences are necessary for our understanding. So we've got a lot of work to do in healthcare. We've got a lot of work.
Doctor, that's the long game. But what about the moment? I mean, we're talking about this vaccine rolling out in the next couple of weeks and months. As we've been talking about Black people disproportionately dying at higher rates from this virus, the trust building needs to happen now. And what does that look like?
Trust is a day in, day out mission. And I say that because that's what I spend a lot of my professional and personal time doing. I just received a text from a community member here in Newark, New Jersey, and she said, "Doc, I gotta be honest. You know, as a Black woman, people are coming to me. They're asking me, how do I feel about this vaccine? And I don't know, do I come out publicly and say that I support it?" So those intimate opportunities where I say, what specifically concerns you about receiving this particular vaccine? We know that there are fears and concerns around the timeline. We need to educate and inform why that happened. Why was it able to happen at a quicker pace? So that's one thing. Another thing is that federal government put so much money, over $9 billion into this process, which removed economic disincentives that drug companies had not to explore manufacturing and testing at the same time, because typically that doesn't happen in clinical research. So we have to share details and facts like that in plain language. We have to speak in plain language about the safety data that's known that, yes, this is a reactogenic vaccine. And what I mean by that is if you take it, you could feel very fatigued. You could have soreness, but you're not infected because you were not exposed to a dead or an activated virus. You were exposed to a genetic code that gave instructions to your body to build a protein so you could mount an immune response. For some people, that level of reassurance is going to help them to say, in this day, yes, I want to get vaccinated. And for other people, we're going to have to put the work in, and that's going to be across days, weeks, months, and even years.
Can we ask you a little bit about your experience in these vaccine trials? You participated in double-blind trials, which means you weren't told you were getting the real vaccine.
Do you think you got a placebo or the real thing? And what was that experience like?
You know, I don't know, right? That's the complexity and the beauty of double-blinded research. But I can tell you, I've never regretted this decision. So the first injection that I received was at the end of August. It hurt, but not such to the point that I couldn't do my activities of daily living. About 28 days later, I got my second injection. That injection was in the beginning of October. All I can say about it was that I got the pain and the tenderness in my arm, but by the end of that day, I was severely fatigued, so much so that I took a while to get out of my car. I had a severe headache, and then within 24 hours, I started to improve. 36 hours and definitely 48 hours, I felt like I was back at my baseline. So I don't know, that could just be me experiencing placebo effect, or I could have received the actual vaccine. But I can tell you, I have never looked back.
As we've been saying, the vaccine will be rolling out over the next few months. Dr. Purnell, your parting words.
I start with two verbs: listen and speak up. And I say listen mainly on the side of healthcare and academic medicine. Listen to their fears. We can't begin to demonize or to create stigma around that skepticism, especially in Black and brown communities, because it will backfire on us. And for those who are still considering, or those who say, I know this is definitely not for me, find someone that you trust and you value and have a back and forth conversation. And that person that you trust and value could be like the National Medical Association, a professional body of Black physicians and Black physician scientists who are in covenant with their community like I am. And from there, I'm hopeful that people will come to the point where they can make an informed choice and decision, because we definitely need this tool in our toolkit.
Dr. Chris Purnell is a public health physician in Newark, New Jersey, and she participated in a Moderna vaccine trial. Her father, Timothy Purnell, died of COVID-19 in April. He was 78 years old. Doctor, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
The number of Americans who filed new unemployment claims shot up last week to the highest level since September. The Labor Department reported today that 853,000 people submitted applications for jobless benefits. The rise in unemployment claims comes as Congress continues to wrangle over the terms of a new pandemic relief bill. Let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. And Ali, you know, economists were projecting only a slight bump in first-time unemployment claims, but as we hear, they rose by more than 100,000 from the week before. So why is that?
Well, so this is partially because economists can't keep up with the rate at which COVID has been spreading. COVID cases are up more than 20% nationwide this week, which has resulted in businesses closing, people staying home even more than they were. We had a record number of deaths reported yesterday. So when you put it all together, the rising rate of infection is restraining consumer spending. We still have very few jobs. And the November jobs report, which we saw in the first week of December, gave us some context. It's the slowest pace of hiring since April. So when you put it all together, you now have 19 million people who are receiving aid under some government form of unemployment. And this is just a direct result of the increase in the cases.
Well, and yet there's, for instance, a program in the first relief package. So if you add people who've applied under that program, the actual number goes up. It's closer to 1.4 million for first-time jobless claims. So what does this tell us about, you know, a broader economic recovery now 9 months into this pandemic?
Well, we had the 853,000 first-time jobless benefits. You just mentioned the 427,000, so you're up to 1.4. What we're seeing is a recovery that it's getting slower rather than faster. Most economists in April and May and June were predicting that as we get closer down, you know, toward the end of the year, by definition, we should be having fewer infections, and that has been turned on its head. So we thought the economic prospects for the end of this year and next year were based on an idea that the economy would be stagnating until we got a vaccine. In fact, we're not not stagnating. We're getting worse. If you don't adjust it for, you know, seasonal activity, which we tend to do in economics, unemployment claims are up by 32% this week compared to last week. The issue comes down to consumer spending, right? If consumers can't spend or don't feel safe spending, they are not going to buy the things that allow business owners to keep people employed. And at the moment, we have a great deal of doubt as to how that works. This is a strange situation, Robin, because there's a light at the end of the tunnel with the vaccines that have started being distributed this week. But that light is quite far and the tunnel's quite dark.
But it's not a train. You know, it is the light at the end of the tunnel. It's coming. But, you know, we still have to wear masks when we get vaccinated. Vaccines are going to take a long time. So just is there a sense of whether some of these job losses might be permanent? And what are the industries? Just real brief.
So it's not likely that most of them will be permanent. The restaurant industry did lose jobs in November for the first time since April. Retail lost 35,000 jobs, although that's transferring to online stuff. Public school employment is down. Most of these will not be permanent. Once we have a vaccine fully distributed, a lot of them will come back.
Right. And hopefully more money will be coming from the government.
Yes, hopefully.
Too. Yeah. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor, economics correspondent, and our friend. Thank you.
Thank you.
These days, deals aren't made over coffee, but instead by sliding into DMs on social media. At least that was the case for writers Kimberly Drew and Jenna Wortham.
Our entire relationship began with a DM exchange, as you mentioned. I reached out. I was a huge fan of Kimberly's Tumblr and just said, you know, do you want to work on something together? And Kimberly was just incredibly gracious and generous, said yes. We had lunch. And that's really how it began.
Today, they're celebrating the publication of their new book, Black Futures. It's the first of a series of books and archives for the future. And like all archives, there's a mix of everything. Photographs, poems, recipes, social media posts, and music playlists that perhaps our children and great-grandchildren will listen to understand this moment, like Frank Ocean's Pink and White.
That's the way every day goes, every time we've no control. If the sky is pink and white, if the ground is black and yellow, it's the same way.
Joining me now are the editors and curators of Black Futures. Kimberly Drew is a writer, curator, and creator of the Tumblr blog Black Contemporary Art. And Jenna Wortham is a staff writer with the New York Times Magazine. She's also the co-host of the podcast Still Processing. Thank you both for joining us.
We're so happy to be with you today.
Black Futures is a time capsule where you are both looking to answer, what does it mean to be Black and alive right now? That is such a big question. How did you go about thinking about who and what kinds of narratives and artifacts needed to be included?
I think for us, we really wanted to draw as wide of a range of possibilities together in the book. I don't think for either of us, we set out to make the declaration, this is exactly what it means to be Black and alive right now. What we wanted to do was pull at a few different strings and bring in and incorporate voices on a global scale that could start to answer that question. I think for both of us, we really see this book as a launching off point, hoping to encourage others to think about archival practices and think about what it means to sit together and really revel at our, you know, greatness and our contributions to the culture and really have a forward-thinking outlook on how we all participate.
Jenna, this book is also nonlinear, but there are 10 subheadings that structure it, which include joy and legacy, Black is beautiful and ownership. How did you all come to this structure?
Well, our publisher, Chris Jackson at One World Books, took a look at all the materials we were aggregating and collecting and thought that it might be a useful way to organize the book into these themes. And of course, the themes they're overlapping and, you know, there are elements of joy that can be part of justice. But it was really just incredible editorial touch to help us, you know, take all the rich materials in the books and not think about them chronologically, but just organizing them into these subheaders. So people have a sense of, you know, these tones and tempos and emotions that they're moving through that we deeply feel throughout the book as well.
Yeah. You know, I'm one of those people who digs into a book and just starts reading it cold without all of the setups and introductions. And one thing I did before I later read your recommendation was that I actually had my phone on hand, as you suggest, to look up a lot of the things I wasn't familiar with. And that turned into a kind of choose your own adventure experience. Was that intentional?
Yes. I think for both of us, we really intended to create something where people felt like they could really come to be nourished. I think we both have had moments in institutions and outside of them where we feel like there's an assumption about how we should move our bodies or the amount of information that we should know before entering into an experience. And I think for both of us in creating this book, we were really interested in creating a volume that could really inform and nourish. And you could take on, you know, maybe 2 pages at a time or 20 pages at a time, but there didn't have to be a particular rhyme or reason through how you flip through the pages.
Jenna, this book also feels like a physical manifestation of digital culture. It's just so visual and nonlinear that it actually feels like I'm clicking through hyperlinks and curating my own experience. But it's also kind of wild to think that this way of consuming media might actually be rudimentary in the future for future generations reading it, or maybe even cool again.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, what's remarkable is that, you know, a lot of the materials we archived in the book did come from social media, and it's pretty bonkers that you can see the interface and how much they've changed. So we have these early
That's
Facebook
true.
Posts from Alicia Garza,
yes.
right? And you yep. can just tell Facebook doesn't look that way anymore. And the same is true of Twitter. And so it is such a time capsule in that way. And I hope that it can be received as such. And yeah, it might feel archaic in the future. And that's kind of cool. Like, I love the idea of somebody stumbling upon it like a shoebox full of mm-hmm. memories of what we were thinking about and what we were hoping for and what was scaring us this year, you know, or I guess in this period of time that we made the book as well.
This is also a blueprint. I mean, Kimberly, there are recipes not just for food, but also how to start an art collection by Erin Haynes, or how to be naked by Adrienne Marie Brown, how to draw a self-care bath, which I actually did on Sunday, by the way.
Ooh.
It's kind of wild to think that 30 to 50 years from now, these recipes, which are so contemporary to our current moment, might actually be artifacts of how we once were.
I know. And that's half the joy of it. I think for both Jen and I, we've been talking a lot about the cookbook as an archive and thinking about how these things get passed down. I had this very funny interaction the other day where I was in a room where people were, you know, of different age groups. And one person mentioned a Rolodex, and seeing the like Gen Zers in the room just completely blank.
Yeah.
Like, what could that thing be? But I think about those bits of ways that we collect information. And of course they age, and of course they change and evolve. But with hopes, you'll be able to take maybe some of the items or the ingredients or even just the intentions in the interest of creating something beautiful in a contemporary moment. I feel like we all take, you know, even with Pierre's cocoa bread recipe in the book, he took a family recipe and made it his own in a completely new and different way. And so I think, you know, as time goes on, hopefully the recipes will continue to be relevant and maybe improved upon by whomever encounters them.
Was there actually a piece that you needed and couldn't imagine the book without?
They're all so vital. I mean, if anything, I feel like we wish we could have stuffed the book with more. You know, I think it's already almost 600 pages. It's such a juicy, thick book. And I really wish we had space for more entries. But everything that's in there feels vital and important, and I can't imagine the book without any of them.
What does it mean for you guys to have this book come out this year, Jenna?
It really feels like a testament to existence. Everything about this year has felt really amorphous and ephemeral and hard to clutch onto. Like, I feel like I'm scrambling for purchase. Like, where are we? What year is it even? Mm-hmm. Why does everything feel so upside down? And there's something, it's the opposite of abstract to hold a physical book in your hands. You know, this is something that we made because we wanted it to be passed around. We wanted people to sit with it. We wanted people to lose themselves in it, and in a way that's not distressing. And I think that so much of the abstractness of this year has been distressing in some ways. And so it feels really important to put out an offering into the world that seems comforting and seems invigorating, and also just seems concrete.
Concrete, but also a beginning. I mean, this is the beginning of an archive. You just started this. I know you guys just published this book and you're riding high on this, but what's next for Black Futures?
The future of Black Futures is with our audience, is with the readers, is with the listeners to the audiobook, is with the people who want to remix the recipes, is with the people who maybe want to sit down with their friends and record their conversations. It's with the people who really put pen to paper on those essays that they've been dreaming about. And there might not be a location for, but it is completely worthy of being written. That's the future of Black Futures. And I think it's just now a matter to see what happens. And I hold hope that some beautiful things might be born.
Thank you both for joining us, Kimberly Drew and Jenna Wortham, editors of the new book, Black Futures.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
And let's end with a selection listed in this book catalog. Here's Sonia Sanchez. She's a poet and leader of the Black Arts Movement, reading her poem, Black Magic.
And so I say to you, Black people, we ought to start a 5-year plan of kissing ourselves, just jumping back and kissing ourselves, and then we're going to believe that we've been bad for a long time, and we're going to get badder. The first set I'm going to do is love poems of a Black woman for her man, and the poem I want to do is called Black Magic. Magic, my man, is you turning my body into 1,000 smiles. Black magic is your touch, making me breathe. Yeah.
If you're someone who likes to go to a club, have a mixed drink, hear a cabaret singer, the pandemic has complicated things. You've got to mix your own drink and sit in front of a computer screen to have an equivalent experience. But it turns out the confessional nature of cabaret translates pretty well online. As reporter Jeff London discovered, some cabaret performers are even being paid.
In pre-pandemic times, Australian cabaret singer Kim David Smith liked to make a dramatic entrance.
I'll enter from the back of the room, caressing shoulders, tussling hair, you know, being just like a slight cabaret menace. And it's just lovely, convivial, and having a nice time and sitting on a lap or three.
Gentlemen can watch while I'm scrubbing the floors, and I'm scrubbing the floors while you're gawking.
Intimacy is cabaret's stock and trade, says Daniel Nardiccio, co-owner of Club Coming NYC.
And to be able to be in a space like Club Coming and be within, like, you know, spitting distance of magic has happened, I feel blessed to say, quite a few times.
But having your hair tussled or someone sit in your lap or, God forbid, be in spitting distance of magic is verboten these days. Like other forms of theater, nightclubs and performers have been facing a whole lot of nothing since March, says singer Gabrielle Stravelli.
It felt like dominoes just kept falling, you know. It was like, oh, this gig next week got canceled. Oh, wow, the gig next month got canceled. Oh, my God, all the gigs over the summer. Wow, that gig I had in October got canceled. I mean, it just went on and on and on.
And no gigs means no money. Enter producer and host of cabaret shows Scott Siegel. He's created a new online service called Nightclub New York.
And it's by subscription, but the idea is that it would be a Netflix of musical theater performance. So we have 35 different stars and the equivalent of, I call them shows, but they're like mini concerts. So they can be 3 songs long or up to 7 songs long.
As you sit there in your loneliness, confused as you must be, I'm sure a dozen questions come to mind.
For $50 a month, you can hear artists like Gabrielle Stravelli in both archival footage from clubs and new performances made in the singer's apartments. Scott Siegel adds,
and the important thing from the performer's point of view and from the audience point of view is that this allows lots of people to get paid.
The quality of the videos and audio on Nightclub New York vary. That's why some physical nightclubs, like Feinstein's 54 Below, are putting more resources into production. Jennifer Ashley Tepper is the club's programming director.
We've seen so much of people coming to us from their apartments that in order to really like monetize and make something that's different in terms of content, the idea has definitely been evolving where more performers have been like going into a studio, live streaming concerts that are actually presumably what a concert would be without the audience, captured in a high quality way on video.
For $25 a ticket, no drinks included, audiences can see multi-camera videos filmed in the empty club, produced with strict COVID-19 protocols starring top-caliber artists like Norm Lewis.
Here comes the jackpot question in advance. What are you doing?
Lewis, who starred on Broadway in Phantom of the Opera and Porgy and Bess, filmed his Christmas show at 54 Below and says he hopes the video captures the flavor of what he normally performs for a small audience.
You know, I had 150 people for 6 nights. Now we can hopefully reach Japan or Europe or Australia, and people can see this fun party that I'm having. And we hope people respond in a very positive way.
Club Cumming NYC owner Daniel Nardiccio says while he misses the atmosphere of a crowded club, there are advantages to video performance.
There's a lot more artistry and intimacy because you do have the closeness of the camera. You can do close-up.
In a small cafe on a crowded night, in a spot of light, stands the singer.
Gabrielle Stravelli says she does her work on camera with the same commitment she would have in a club.
Even though that feedback isn't immediate, we know that those people are receiving it. So I think we can still perform the way we do in intimate spaces.
With a vaccine in the near future, at some point, live cabaret shows will return. But producer Jennifer Ashley Tepper thinks video performances probably won't be going away.
I really think that one of the things that is going to come out of this time is a hybrid model of like live and virtual. We're going to have more cabaret and theater where you are in the theater watching it, but you can also buy and watch it at home. I could be wrong, but I just keep thinking about that as like a potential positive.
Which means you could choose to be in spitting distance of a performer or not. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.